Last week, we looked at Esther, so we're going to pick up this week. Now, I am a firm believer in not preaching like a 52-part sermon series. I really feel like after about 4 or 6 weeks, you kind of lose interest. So we're not going to dig into every piece of the story of Esther, okay? Because that was going to take us way past Easter. It'd take a long time. So my plan is to kind of synopsis some points as we go through. Is that okay with everybody? Excellent. Because I don't really have an alternate plan for this morning if you're not okay with that. So we left Esther. She has won in chapter 2 the beauty pageant. That's completed, right? She's now appointed as queen. So what we are seeing is in chapter 2, verse 20, she's still keeping her identity as a Jewish secret because Mordecai told her to, okay? She still has not disclosed this. Mordecai, too, it seems, according to the scriptures, is keeping it secret. In chapter 2, verse 22, Mordecai hears the plot of Bigthana and Teresh, not good names to name your children if you're considering some, to murder the king. So he overhears this plan at the city gate. He goes in verse 23, finds Esther, tells her what's going on and the plan to kill the king. Esther goes to the king, and when she tells the king, she says, "Hey, P.S., this isn't me. Mordecai, who serves you, is the one who wanted you to know this and is protecting you." So the king is really happy with Mordecai. The two men with the weird names are hung, and the details, it says, are recorded in the annals so that everybody knows what happened. In chapter 3, we see Haman is promoted and is on a power trip, and he is kind of loving that everybody has to bow down to him. Now, the one thing you need to know about Haman is that Haman is actually a descendant of the Amalekites. So if you remember last year when we talked about Joshua and we kind of talked about all of those giants and the people that they were coming up against, he descended from the family line of the Amalekites, who basically were seen or known as the complete opposite of the Jews. Anything the Jews believed, they were opposite and were out to get them. So that kind of explains what proceeds to happen. So Haman is excited because everyone's bowing down and worshiping him. However, Mordecai refuses, because Mordecai knows that you're not to worship anyone other than God. You're not to bow down to someone else. Haman doesn't like that. So he decides that he is not going to just take care of Mordecai. He doesn't want to just get punishment on Mordecai for his lack of submission. He wants to try and go after all of the Jewish people, which kind of comes out of this Amalekite root, is what theologians see there, right? Because they've always been out for this people group from the beginning. And so that's not going to change now. Now, instead of getting one of them, he can try and wipe out the entire group of them here. So in chapter 3, verse 9, he gets the king to issue a decree to destroy all of the Jews without ever identifying them as a people group. I don't know about you, but as a parent, when my children come in a room and they start trying to get someone in trouble, my first question is, who? Who did what? Why? The king doesn't seem to ask. When Haman goes in, he's like, there are these people. They are unsubmissive. They're unruly, blah, blah, blah. The king says, deal with them as you wish. Kind of weird, right? He's got a lot of things to deal with, but blindly issues the decree, lets Haman issue the decree of whatever is going to happen. Esther, at this point in the story, has gone from being an orphan, like we talked about last week. She has no parents. She's raised by Mordecai, and she now is the queen. She's had a complete 180 in her life. Life is not looking like anything she is familiar with. She has been raised in the scriptures, so she knows God's promises, right? She knows that God has a plan for her life. She knows that things point back to Yahweh, right? Even though we don't see his name mentioned in the book. Can you imagine for a second, as you try and adjust to this plan, that God has decided to take you from an orphan, which scripture refers to as the least of these, right? In the New Testament, Jesus says to take care of the orphans and the widows and the least of these, and now positioned her as the queen of one of the ruling empires. That's a huge position shift, right? Have you ever had to switch jobs? Or you get married, you have an identity crisis sometimes, right? You're trying to sort out how to get your feet back underneath you. Esther had to go through that to some extent, and we touched on that last week. She had to go through, hey, what is my purpose as the queen? What does this look like? How does this play out? So I'm pretty sure here that she's got to be fairly confused about what this means, because she's living in the palace. The king has more concubines than he can count, right? So it's not like, okay, you're a husband and you're a wife and there's two of you. In this dynamic, she's fighting for attention, or not even able to fight, because there's concubines, there's her, there's a country that he's got to rule. She's isolated from her friends and her family. She can't she can see Mordecai maybe sometimes, but the people that are around her are no longer the people that she's familiar with. And yet to everybody else, it looked like she had it all. But she probably felt that she was lacking much. She probably felt pretty alone. So when we make the jump from Esther chapter 2 to Esther chapter 3 and 4, 5 years actually pass. I always read this story like it was sequential. It happened right away. But when you dig into history, from the point in time that Esther is appointed as queen to the point in time that Mordecai catches the conspiracy at the gate and then comes to Esther and she goes to the king and walks that plan out, there's 5 years of time that passes. That changed my perspective just a little bit. So that means she has lived in the palace for a minimum of 6 years, probably a little bit more, right? Because scripture tells us that it was 12 months of beauty treatments once they started them before they appeared before the king. So for 6 months, she's been living in the palace. She's knowing people. She's knowing how they interact. She's knowing the ebbs and flows and the rules and all these kinds of things. But she's also been married for 5 years. What does marriage look like 5 years in? Think back if you're married. When we were married 5 years, we had 2 kids. I was pregnant with number 3. You're kind of finding a little bit of a rhythm to life. Most marriage books say that year number 5 is not a good year. Okay, if you study marriage, if you do any kind of counseling, year 5 is not good. Because by year 5, you're feeling a little bit more comfortable in the relationship. So you're maybe commenting a little bit more on things that are not quite sitting with you. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? And so they say that marriage is actually run in a 7-year cycle. The first couple years, the honeymoon phase, they're great. And then you hit year 3 and it's all right. Year 5, you're starting to express yourself a little bit more freely and getting comfortable. Year 6, you're kind of paying the paybacks of that one and it's getting kind of, year 7, it's not great and it's starting to come back up. And then you go through the 7-year cycle all over again. That's statistically what they say happens. There are exceptions, but as a general rule of thumb, that's the pattern. But in this situation, if Esther's going through the typical year 5, it doesn't mention she has any kids, which probably was looked down upon in this culture, right? As a queen, your responsibility would be to produce offspring. So there's probably some tension around that in her life. She also is probably realizing 5 years in that things are a little bit uncomfortable, but when you're married to the king, you don't get to tell him. So she's like bottling up probably a lot of emotions and observations about life in the palace. When I read this story knowing that, my perspective changes. Because in my old perspective, when I thought it was kind of sequential, I kind of thought she was still on a high in this chapter. When you read it as though it just happened, she's just become queen, she's just won the beauty pageant, life is going great for Esther when Mordecai comes to her. But that gap kind of means that there's probably stories in there that we just don't know about, right? So for me, it frames what happens next a little bit differently. Chapter 3, which we're going to skip through, these are the highlights that I want you to kind of keep in your memory bank. Chapter 3, verse 7, they cast the pur, that's the lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month, and the lot fell on the 12th month of the month of Adar. So that's Haman and his generals cast this lot to decide when they're going to go after the Jewish people. So the king says to Haman in verse 11 of chapter 3, do with the people as you wish. So in verse 13, we see the dispatches were sent by couriers to all of the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all of the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that they would be ready for that day. The lot's cast, all of this happens. Mordecai knows all of this, okay? Esther doesn't. That's what we see as we read through the scriptures. We're going to pick it up in chapter 4, verse 1. Chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and the order of the king had come, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Mordecai is devastated. I'm fairly confident that Mordecai chose his location for fasting and wailing for a couple reasons. One, probably because there were multiple people gathered there. But Mordecai knew that the closest he could get to Esther was that gate. Clearly, after 6 years in the palace, her people that cared for her knew that there was some sort of connection between the two of them. Even if they didn't know they were family, they seem to, based on the rest of the story, know that there's some sort of connection between Mordecai and Esther, that they talk back and forth. So Mordecai can't go in because of his fasting, but surely someone is going to look out and see Mordecai. In this place, he is positioned so that he can get the information to her, even though he can't get the information to her. Look a little bit further. When Esther's maids and eunuchs, verse 4, came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. So Esther's response is, "Oh my goodness, what's going on? Here, put on some clothes and come tell me." Seems logical, right? Let's get this under wraps and let's have a conversation. However, Mordecai refuses the clothing. Does that seem a little bit weird? If you had a problem that was going to affect our nation, and you had someone who had access to Parliament Hill and the Prime Minister, and all you needed to do was put on some clothes so you could go talk to them, does it not seem logical to do so? And yet he makes the choice not to. I am pretty sure that what we witness in this story next is the world's worst game of broken telephone. Slide, do you guys remember playing broken telephone as a kid or with your grandchildren? It's my least favorite game in the absolute world. Least, because the message never gets through right? But in this circumstance, it seems to. And you got to consider, it would be like if Cameron and I were playing broken telephone, but I was here and Cameron was at Shoppers Drug Mart, and we had Aaron running back and forth the messages between us. That's the kind of dynamic we're talking about, right? There's a distance, there's physical exertion. In all of this, the fate of a nation rests on the communication that's running back and forth between these people. That is the scene that we see here. It's a little bit dramatic, right? Just a little bit. In Esther chapter 4, we're going to read in verse 6. We'll go to 5. Esther summoned Hatat, one of the king's eunuchs, assigned to attend to her, and ordered him to come find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. So Hatat went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show Esther and to explain it to her. And then he told him to urge her to go to the king's presence and to beg for mercy and to plead for him with her people. Hatach went back to Esther and reported everything that Mordecai had said. Mordecai just doesn't tell Esther what's going on. He gives her every possible detail she could potentially know. He leaves nothing into question, right? In this game of broken telephone, he lays it all out perfectly. The thing is that if you look at chapter 2, verse 20, we find out a little bit of a foreshadowing of what Mordecai probably expected to happen here. It says in 2:20, but Esther kept her kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. Mordecai expected Esther to follow his instructions. That's the kind of kid she was. She's a rule follower. You say this, she does this. You say this, she does this. Mordecai was expecting Esther to go, one would think, based on these passages, and say, okay, yeah, I got this. I'll talk to the king. However, that's not really the way that things play out. When I read what's happening in this conversation, I hear desperation in Esther's voice. Esther's response to Mordecai is, she instructed him, Hatach, to go back to Mordecai and say, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king has but one law. He's to be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and to spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. This is not hopeful, not even a little bit. Hey, Mordecai, in case you don't know, I'm feeling a little bit isolated. I'm feeling a little bit trapped in my room with my attendants, and you want me to go talk to the king. I've been here for 6 years. Everybody knows you don't talk to the king alone. You don't go approach the king. Hey, and P.S., I can't even fake that I like dropped an earring or something when I talked to him last night because I haven't seen him in 30 days. I don't know about you, but 5 years into my marriage, if I hadn't seen my husband in 30 days and had a conversation and we were in the same building, it probably wouldn't be a good scene. There's a lot of insecurity that comes in that, right? She knows all of the other people that he has to have relationships with and friendships with and responsibilities, but he's not even calling her. Her beauty isn't even enough at this point that it's drawing her into his presence. There's not a play that she has here, as far as she can see, that gets her into his presence in a way that she is not going to be killed. That's desperate. It's desperate to communicate that back to the person who you always do whatever they tell you to do. What I want you to know is that God's timing is not always our timing. This was not Esther's time. When Esther looked at the facts, when she looked at 5 years of marriage, over 6 years in the king's palace, I've got to be summoned, I haven't seen him in 30 days. Mordecai, your timing stinks. You are 30 days too late. You ever felt like that with God? You want me to what, God? You're about 3 years too early or 5 years too late. I'm sorry, I'm tapped out. God's timing for what he desires to do in and through us doesn't look like our timing. And so sometimes we're faced with these moments that God is saying, hey, you know what? It's time to step out and do something. And we're going, yeah, no, this is really bad timing. Like, I just got a new job and we got a new baby, or we're retiring and we don't have funds right now. And God is saying, hey, it's not about your timing. This is not about your ideal set of circumstances. This was not about Esther's ideal set of circumstances. She faced death if this played out wrong. But God in his providence prepares a way. When God moves us to do something, we don't get to question his timing. It's just the way it is. Oftentimes, we see in scripture and in the testimony of people we know that when God is about to do something, things don't look good. Esther is in a national political chaos that is swirling this way, right? The entire Jewish people are going to be destroyed. Inside of that circle, in her personal sphere, her marriage is not doing so hot by her accounts. She's not having a relationship with her husband. She doesn't know what her purpose is. She doesn't know why God would have placed her in the palace to be in a marriage where she's lonely and talking more to people who are just her servants. The girl is in crisis. And God says, hey, it's time. Have you ever had God say it's time in crisis? I think he does it because we have to depend on him. That's my personal theory. And I would encourage you that if you're in a season that feels like crisis, and it feels like everything's just going wrong, and yet somehow someone comes to you who, like Mordecai, is a trusted voice of spiritual reason in your life and says, hey, it's time to go. Don't listen to just anyone. Listen to people with weight behind them. But when they say it, it's worth considering, no matter what the timing looks like on your end. There are a lot of ways that I can look where we're at as a church right now, and I can say, man, it doesn't make sense that it's our time to go. But yet, if God has said it, it's our time to go. It's our time to move. It's our time to be where he has positioned us to be, and we can't let anything stop us from doing that personally or corporately. And I really think that's what I see in this story. Pick it up in verse 12, if I can get the next. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. Mordecai probably knew that Esther was struggling a little bit because they had been talking, right? He probably knew she was struggling with, why am I even in this kingdom? Hey, who knows? Maybe you've been put in the kingdom for this moment. Maybe. God's purposes and plans aren't always as clear as anything. Sometimes the biggest things he has for us to do come in the weirdest packages that seem completely obscure, and yet he's still in them. Mordecai says, if you remain silent at this time, the Amplified Version says, liberation and rescue will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish, since you did not help them when you had the chance. And who knows whether you have attained royalty for such a time as this and for this very purpose. Esther, if you don't step out now and say something, you know what? God is God. He's going to protect his people. But your family is going to be done. So make your choice. Make your choice. In English, Beth Moore points out that this who knows, okay, this question of who knows is something called aposiopesis. It's a painful word. What it means is that it's breaking off of what's being said so that the mind is more impressed by what is being left unsaid. To being wonderful, solemn, or it being too wonderful, solemn, or awful to verbalize in English. This figure is often called the sudden silence. Wikipedia says aposiopesis is where a sentence is deliberately broken off and left unfinished, the ending to be supplied by the imagination, giving the impression or unwillingness or inability to confuse. Esther, what's our option? You do this or... That's basically what Mordecai is telling her. You move or... Do you know what the end of the sentence is? I've had it up to here with your behavior, fill in child's name. Get to your room or else. We all know what the or else is, right? There's not a parent who has said that who doesn't know their child who's heard it that doesn't know the ending. Mordecai is saying, listen, you don't think you know, but God knows. And P.S., you know. Who else could be called? Who knows? You know. God knows. He knows his plans. He knows his purpose. I am confident that it was incredibly overwhelming. But Esther realized there was no alternative. Her options were death or death, really, at the end of the day. She either goes to the king and she risks death, or she doesn't go to the king and she gets killed with all the Jewish people. Who knows? Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go and gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day, and I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, and even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. In spite of her earlier doubt, Esther respects what Mordecai has to say. She clearly has some kind of revelation that death is on her doorstep either way. Not a great spot to be sitting 5 years into your marriage. Either your husband's going to kill you in person, or his edict is going to send people after you to kill you. What I love about this moment is that Esther is convinced that she's going to have to do this, but she is not going to go this alone. And she calls a nationwide fast. Nationwide. And not just a partial fast. Not just a full fast. She tells them they can't even have water. It also tells us that not only do all of the Jewish people fast with her, as she says, that all of the people who are serving her also fast, which means either that she had Jews serving her, or there's a huge theory that of the people serving her, she had actually converted them to Judaism in her time with them. She is not willing to go to the king on her own. She recognizes that if God has positioned her for such a time as this, she's not going without him going with her. And so for 3 days, she's going to get on her face and she's going to fast and she's going to seek God. Fasting is not done for the purpose of bending God's ear. Okay, she's not doing this to try and convince God that he should have her back. That's not what's going on. Fasting is when you deny yourself food for spiritual purposes. It draws us closer to God. It sharpens our intercession. It gives us a passion to our requests. It doesn't change God's will or cause him to reconsider. It doesn't change his hearing as much as it changes our praying. Esther's prayers on day one of that fast and Esther's prayers on day three of that fast, they couldn't have been the same. They couldn't have been. You can't deny yourself everything you need to survive for 3 days and be the same. At 3:30 this morning, I woke up from a dead sleep for no good reason. Other than I appeared to be starving, I had eaten dinner at 4:30 and I didn't have anything else when I came home. And my stomach was just like churning. And I really didn't have enough energy to get up and I didn't feel like I was supposed to get up. And I felt like God said, you know what, Stephanie, you're just supposed to pray right now. 3:30 in the morning, he does this to me every now and again. I don't really like it, but he keeps doing it and I think I know why. But so I spent over 2 hours praying in the middle of the night. My prayers at the beginning of the hour and the end of hour two are not the same prayers. Because by the end, I went from praying from the discomfort of my stomach to knowing that God's desire is for revival to fall in our church and in our community, and he wants to use us to make it happen. And so what are we going to do to bring it about? Not because we're doing anything, but because we want to hear what he has for us. 3 days, that was 2 hours. Esther was moved. She was compelled. She was not just a beautiful queen walking into the king's presence. She was a woman full of the Spirit and anointed by God who went in to do battle for her people. What battle do you have that you need to be full of the Spirit to go into? We as a culture don't fast very much, do we? I've heard a lot of, well, I'll fast TV. I'll let it go. Right? It's not a bad thing. But guys, when you don't know what to do and you don't know where to go and you feel attacked at every angle... Scripture is so clear that prayer and fasting is the place that you need to go and find yourself. And maybe if it's a huge thing, listen, for every Facebook post that I see about what a horrible prime minister we have, I would like to see 5 that say, let's pray and fast for our nation on Tuesday. If we don't like what's going on, what are we doing about it in the heavenlies? If we don't like what we're experiencing in our communities, what are we doing about it in the heavenlies? Why am I fighting it on my own when I can be fighting it with you? Esther says, it's not enough that I pray and fast. We are all going to pray and fast, because if God is in this and for such a time as this, then we're all getting on our knees, because we're not going into battle without him. Guys, I'm not going into battle without him. I won't. And you shouldn't either. If life is falling apart, if things look messy, the chaos is spinning, hey, heads up, God's probably doing something. Get on your knees and start listening. That is what we learn in this story of Esther. Life isn't always easy, even for a girl like Esther, who seemingly won the lottery. She won the jackpot as far as girls of her day and age were concerned. Life in the king's palace, chosen because you're beautiful. But at the end of the day, you have to trust that God knows what he's doing. He has plans for us, plans that involve him walking right alongside of us, that include the future we hope for. The journey there may in no way look like what we had anticipated. The destination might not resemble the ideal one that we were shooting for. But hey, he's the guy who knows best. He's the guy who knows best. It applies to us corporately. It applies to us personally. Who are we to question his plans and purposes? To question his timing. So here's the thing. You have to trust God's timing, no matter how unreasonable it looks. You need to remember that God's purposes won't be stopped. You can choose to not engage with them, but he's going to work around you. But you'll get left out. That's what Mordecai tells Esther. Hey, don't be confused. God's purposes, they're going to happen whether you choose to engage or not. But for the record, if you don't choose to engage, not only are you going to be affected, but your children are going to be affected. Your family's going to be affected. And I do think that stands for us today. If God speaks and you choose not to move, don't worry. He's God. It's going to happen. The church family for this community, they're not going to be thwarted because one of us doesn't obey what he's impressed on our hearts. But don't be foolish and think that you just get to roll into all of the benefits of those things and there's not going to be some fallout somewhere else. His love is unconditional. His grace is extended. But, hey, if you don't step in, Esther, don't think you're going to escape the consequences. When you don't know what's going on and things are too stressful, 3, pray and fast so that you can draw close to him and be found in his safekeeping, in his guidance, and draw close to his heart. Guys, there are a lot of us who are going through some stuff. There's a lot of us. And I think it's because God is about to do something. I could be foolish. It's what I sense. And if we don't walk into what it is that he has for us, we're going to miss it and he's going to pick somebody else. And for me, this isn't about, I got to be a part of it, right? It's not about, for Esther, nothing that she does in this story at any part has anything to do with her making her name great. To be honest, she seems to shy away from her position and title as queen throughout the entire book of Esther. Guys, we've got to be where God has for us to be, because being where he has for us to be, it affects everybody else around us. He has strategically positioned each of you for such a time as this. What is the thing that he desires for you to step into? What is the thing he desires for us to step into, to be the people he has called for us to be? And if you don't know, or you know, but you don't know how to do it, call some friends. Pray and fast. Guys, we need to look at the significance of prayer and fasting in a culture that has completely walked away from it. In a culture that says, satisfy yourself with everything you want, we serve a God who says, deny yourself and find your satisfaction in me. That's pretty big. And so this morning, we're going to close. I'm going to ask Troy, maybe if you could just come back up to the guitar and just strum. I don't know what specifically each of you are going through. But I know that if I feel corporately as a church that we're pushing ahead and advancing, and I know what's going on in my life, then I will be foolish not to think that some of you don't have some things in your life that are for such a time as this moment, that you are wrestling it with God. And so this morning, I am going to, Troy prays, I'm just going to open up the front. I'm not going to pray with you. I'm not going to come lay hands on with you. Nobody else is either. If you need to go, you can go. But if you need to stay and press into God and seek him on some pretty heavy things that he is pushing on your heart, please know that this is the place and this is the time, because he desires to move in what you are going through. But if you don't stop and seek him, you are never going to know. You're never going to know the potential outcome. You're never going to know the potential options. You're never going to know the power that he can make manifest in you through the situation that you find yourself in. I'm going to go back to my seat. I'm going to come up and close in prayer. If you need to go before I come back up, please feel free to do so. But otherwise, you can sit in your seat. You can come to the front. And I just encourage you, press in. Take out a pen and paper if you need to and write stuff down. Find a friend to pray for you if that's what you feel you need to do. But guys, we gotta wrestle this stuff out or we're going to get stuck. And he's going to go around us and pick somebody else because he's not going to be stopped.